Thanks, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Doug, for that very kind introduction, and thanks to the Mises Institute and its chair, Lou Rockwell, for the opportunity to it gave me to speak with to all of you today about a very important subject. I want to explain a little bit the background behind the topic I've chosen today. As Doug mentioned, I wrote a book not very long ago, published a book that I'd worked on for quite a long time. And, you know, after a project like that, you feel exhausted for a while. It really takes a lot out of you. And so I've been in that state for some time, and recently I was fishing around for a kind of easy project to kind of ease myself back into the research mode with. And that's why I decided to write a paper asking the question, has the Fed been a failure? But as you might be able to see, it's kind of a long paper, right? Because for most of you, I might have just had a one word, and then it would have been done, and you would have said, well, I'm convinced, and that would have been the end of it. But here I have a somewhat a different audience in mind, and a different overall objective than to merely declare the Fed a failure or affirm that it's a failure. And the purpose is to ask the question whether there is need to consider, that is rather to convince economists that there is as much need today to look for some radical alternatives to the Federal Reserve System as there was need 100 centuries ago to look for alternatives, an alternative, to the then existing national currency system that had been in place for about 50 years since the Civil War. You may know, perhaps, that it was in 1910, in fact, that the National Monetary Commission reported on alternatives to the established U.S. monetary system of that day. In other words, it was exactly a century ago. The Commission's report consisted of a shelf of volumes examining alternative monetary systems, their history, and so on. Mind you, the Commission was a stacked deck. The whole point of it by then was to conclude that, yes, we needed something like a central bank. But the general idea of examining existing alternatives or possible alternatives, that was a good idea. And it was motivated by the fact that there had been a series of relatively serious, well, I can't say relatively anymore, but serious financial crises leading up to the Commission's report. And it was generally understood that that system, that is the system that prevailed for money and banking between the Civil War and 1910, was, after all, not working very well. Well, today I believe we have enough reason to ask the same questions about the Fed's performance. And what I seek to do in my paper, and what I wish to do here, though I don't think it's quite as difficult in this context, is to make the case that the Federal Reserve has been no less successful in solving this country's monetary and financial problems than the previous system, that is, the system it replaced, was successful at solving those problems. That is, the Fed has not even improved on the system it was supposed to replace. Also, to make my project a little more challenging, perhaps, I want to make this case using evidence and arguments from prominent mainstream economists. I will not appeal even once today to works by Austrian economists or other known critics of the Federal Reserve System. On the contrary, I'm going to make the case that the Fed has been a flop using only arguments to be found in mainstream outlets, professional economics journals, by prominent economists, many of whom do not consider themselves at all critics of the Fed. Indeed, I'll even quote some testimony and argument from prominent Federal Reserve authorities themselves in making my case. And in this way, I hope to convince not so much people like all of you who are reasonably open-minded, intelligent, and incredulous when it comes to conventional wisdom, but economists who you may have gathered from some of the other talks this weekend can be rather dim-witted people who need to have lots of evidence before they can start to see something that is plain to see to almost any other kind of human being. Now, I want to start out by noting what the Fed claims its own mission to be, so that we can judge it by its own standards. That is, we only have to ask whether the Fed has done what it says it's supposed to do. Here is a statement of the Fed's mission from the Humphrey-Hawkins Amendment to the Federal Reserve Act, which is what governs the Fed's operations today. And you see that it says that its purpose is, quote, to promote effectively the goals of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. Further, from the Federal Reserve Board's website, we read that the Fed has the additional purpose of containing financial disruptions and preventing their spread around outside the financial sector. So that gives us a fairly straightforward set of criteria by which to evaluate the Fed's performance. We can ask, how good a job has it done stabilizing prices? How good a job has it done preventing or stabilizing output? How good a job has it done preventing banking crises? And finally, how good a job has it done acting as a lender of last resort in connection with such crises? These seem to be the relevant points worth looking at. Now, I want to, before beginning my evaluation, let's look at what the Federal Reserve authorities themselves have to say about the importance of stable prices, about how costly it can be not to have stable prices. Here is a quote from the Board of Governors again. I'll read it for the sake especially of those of you way in the back. Stable prices in the long run are a precondition for maximum sustainable output growth and employment, as well as moderate long-term interest rates. When prices are stable and believed to remain so, the prices of goods, services, materials, and labor are undistorted by inflation and serve as clearer signals and guides to the efficient allocation of resources. Moreover, stable prices foster saving and capital formation because when the risk of erosion of asset values resulting from inflation and the need to guard against such losses are minimized, households are encouraged to save more and businesses are encouraged to invest more. This is the Fed's own statement. And here is a further statement by Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke from a few years ago. Quote, stable prices allow people to rely on the dollar as a measure of value when making long-term contracts, engaging in long-term planning, or borrowing or lending for a long period. As economist Martin Feldstein has frequently pointed out, price stability also permits tax laws, accounting rules, and the like to be expressed in dollar terms without being subject to distortions arising from fluctuations in the value of money. By the way, the same fellow, Feldstein, estimated that the losses to the public from tax distortion effects alone of inflation, of 2% inflation relative to zero, amounted to 1% of annual, 1% of the nation's GDP. And that's only a small part of the cost of inflation. All right, then. We see that all people at the Fed are in agreement that stable prices are very important. This is a chart of the Consumer Price Index. I'm not questioning standard measures of the value of money. For this, again, I want this to be an imminent criticism. I don't want to rely on anything that most economists would find controversial. $100 in 1790, that is at the beginning of the Republic, was worth the same amount as $108 in 1913. And as you can tell from the chart, you could pick pretty much any figure from before 1913, and it would almost have the same value as a 1913 figure. So 100 is worth 108 in 1913. $108 in 1913, however, was the equivalent of about $2,500 today. Moreover, if you were to examine this chart more closely, you'd see another pattern, and that pattern is simply this, that the greater the Federal Reserve's command over the money supply, the less the Fed has been constrained itself by the gold standard in particular, which was done away with only in stages starting in the 30s and ending in the 70s, early 70s, the more rapidly the price level has tended to rise, the more the dollar has lost purchasing power. And that suggests, of course, that there is, after all, no coincidence in the fact that the dollar has lost value since the Fed has been in charge, and the more the Fed is in charge, the more the dollar loses value. Now, Bernanke's statement and others also point to the instability of the price level and not just the stable rate of inflation as something to be avoided. Let's look at the inflation rate since 1914. One of the things that everybody knows is that we had very bad inflation in the 70s. Very bad. Double digit. But it was mostly the low teens, those double digits. What a lot of people don't know is the Fed did not wait nearly that long to use its powers of monetary control to cause severe inflation, indeed the worst peacetime inflation in history. It did so within a few years of its establishment. Between 1916 and 1920, the inflation rate bounced around between 15 and 20% on an annual basis, with some monthly rates, annually adjusted, of 25%. And by the way, it did that in part because although it didn't suspend the gold standard during World War I, there were some restrictions on gold exports. There was an embargo that restricted gold exports. So here again, it's the extent of the inflation is directly related to the extent to which the Fed is free to do whatever it wants in managing the money supply. Now, some boring statistics, but I won't go into the details of what's behind them. Suffice to say that if you're concerned about the unpredictability of the price level, then one way to gauge that is by trying to fit price level movements into a statistical model. Well, if you do that, you find the following results. This was actually done by an economist who published the results in, I think, the AER, but a prominent journal. Basically, before the Fed, inflation is a, quote, white noise process. That basically means it just fluctuates nicely around zero with the tendency to revert to zero. But as the Fed gains control of the money supply, the process generating inflation starts to include important components of drift until since 1960, or since the time when the Fed began to break the last of the links to the gold standard, inflation has become a random walk. That is to say, pretty much unpredictable. And that's when the costs of inflation become the greatest. So, that's inflation. Now, some mainstream economists might be tempted to say, well, all right, the Fed has caused inflation. We all know that the price level has risen a lot under its administration of money. But after all, it has eradicated deflation, and we know that deflation is a scourge to be avoided at all costs. However, even according to some recent work by mainstream economists, it's not the case that deflation is always bad. On the contrary, there are two kinds of deflation, you might say, good and bad. And I will hasten to say, actually, deflation per se is never bad. It's a response to a relative shortage of money compared to goods, and it's sometimes the best possible response. But let's just allow, though, that less controversially, deflation can be caused either by a shrinkage of the demand for goods by people spending less, or by a change in supply. Conventionally, again, conventionally, bad deflation happens when demand shrinks, right? People are spending less, and so the prices of goods will tend to fall. If for any reason prices can't fall right away, there can be a short-run period, or perhaps not such a short-run period, when you have unsold goods and unemployment, because labor also can be unsold. That's what happened notoriously in the Great Depression. I'm not denying the boom-bust part of that story, but the other part was FDR preventing prices from falling through the National Recovery Administration, and that made the Depression last much longer. But prices may fall simply because goods are being produced more efficiently. So there are more goods being sold, their unit costs of production are declining, and the decline in price that follows with constant demand or spending is a reflection of declining goods prices. All right. Well, let's get back to the question, has the Fed at least made up for some of the inflation it's caused through its service of eradicating deflation? And the answer is, what the Fed has done is to eliminate all the good deflation, but it also has uniquely contributed to the only known episode of severe bad inflation in modern history. Here is a quote from an article from the American Economic Review a few years ago by the authors Atkinson and Kehoe. A broad historical look, they conclude, finds many more periods of deflation with reasonable growth than with depression, and many more periods of depression with inflation than with deflation. Moreover, the same authors find that, and this is surveying many countries, not just the U.S., the only episode in the 20th century of bad deflation was the Great Depression. And of course, the Fed was in charge then. If you go back to the 19th century, the conclusions are the same. There was, in that case, there was plenty of deflation. It was quite common to have deflation in the, at least for fairly long spans of time. I'm sorry, I don't mean to show you that yet, in the 19th century. But most of the deflation, in fact, practically all of it, was good deflation. There was relatively little bad deflation. So once again, the Fed caused bad inflation, it caused bad deflation, it got rid of only one thing, good deflation. So that's two wrongs and no rights. Let's talk about stability of output. Let's talk about that for a bit. It used to be thought that the Fed had stabilized output and also employment substantially, or rather, that it had done so since World War II. By the way, most comparisons, including my own, of the Fed's performance with the performance of the monetary arrangement that preceded it, are comparisons of pre-World War I performance, right, pre-Fed, and post-World War II. We leave out the interwar period, including the Great Depression. Why? Well, as everyone knows, that was practice. And so, if we do that, of course, and can still make a case that the Fed has not made things better, we have a very strong case indeed. Because everyone agrees, there has been no period of more severe economic volatility, unemployment, or almost any other bad you can imagine, apart from inflation, at least, than the 1930s or the interwar period generally, because there was another fairly severe but short-lived crisis in 1920-21. And then there was inflation, of course, in the early, in the World War I period itself. All right. Well, it turns out that the estimates of volatility that used to be relied upon for output came from an economist named Kuznets, and they were based on unpublished output figures, GNP figures he'd come up with for before World War I. Why did Kuznets never publish these figures? Because he didn't think they were reliable. In fact, in order to construct them, he had to make a very, very bold assumption, namely that the volatility of pre-World War I GNP more or less was tracking that of commodity output. In other words, that commodity output, the total output was as volatile as commodity output. Well, we know that that's just hardly ever true since the Second World War, when we have accurate statistics for both total and commodity output. We see that total output is only 60% as volatile as commodity output. So treating, guessing or estimating total output for before World War I using commodity money output as a guide gives you very exaggerated measures of pre-World War I volatility. Well, an economist who's been mentioned in this conference, Christina Romer, who is, of course, head of the Council of Economic Advisors, did a study where she revised the volatility figures to correct this bias that Kuznets figures contained. And these are the results. And what you can see is that for industrial production, the period before 1914 involves a volatility that's somewhat greater than after World War II, but not substantially. This is measured by standard deviation, right? For GNP, it's 3 versus 2.5. Again, not remarkably worse. For commodity output, it's very similar, 5.2 to 4.9. And then unemployment, again, slightly worse, but not much. This is leaving the Great Depression period, the crisis of 21 and 20, out of the story. If you include those, of course, the volatility was much greater at that time. The Fed's overall performance is obviously worse. But indeed, even if you don't, I thought I had a quote from Romer. Let me read, I'm sorry, it hasn't made it into the slideshow, but let me read Romer's own conclusion on this, right? This is from the head of the present Council of Economic Advisors. It'll just take me a moment here. I can't find it. You're just going to have to take my word for it. She actually says, I know, it's coming up. It's coming up in connection with the recessions. Pardon me. We'll get to it. One more thing about volatility, though, right, about how much output fluctuates. It's very important to realize that if we're really wanting to evaluate monetary systems, what we're concerned about isn't the overall instability or variability of output. It's the contribution of monetary changes to that variability. That is, it's the component or the portion of the variability that you can trace to fluctuations in money supply and spending. Because, of course, output can vary owing to so-called supply shocks or supply innovations over which monetary authorities have no control, and which monetary policy really shouldn't try to eliminate. These are non-monetary fluctuations. Well, here again are some fancy statistics, and I won't trouble you to explain how they're derived, but these are two sets of estimates of the forecast error variances attributable to supply shocks, that is, supply innovations before 1914 and after World War II, the bigger the share you can blame on supply innovations, the less monetary policy is responsible, the less it's the fault of the monetary system. Well, by one set of estimates, and we need to look at the short horizons, don't ask why, but it's almost 100% is supply innovations before World War I. In other words, it's not the monetary system, it's harvest failures and such. Whereas after, the figures from the same study are more like, from one of them, like 5%. Another study reports a figure of about 89% supply induced fluctuations in output. If you take these figures into account, then the story ends up being something like this, that although output fluctuates a little more after World War II than it did before World War I, the monetary component of output fluctuations, the extent to which it's due to a poorly behaved monetary system is more or less much larger after World War II than before World War I. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So, now let's talk about business cycles. Since measuring output is so tricky, especially before World War I, it may be safer to focus on looking at the number and duration of recessions, right? We don't, without asking how deep they were, right, which requires having good measures of output and such. So, did the Fed at least succeed in reducing the frequency or duration of recessions? Well, according to the old NBER statistics, there were many more recessions before World War I, and they lasted longer, a lot longer than they have since. The only problem is, if you look at how the NBER was measuring recessions before World War I, how it estimated their existence and length, well, let me put it this way. I'm going to try to be as polite as I can. The only way they could have been more unscientific about it would have been if they had been using sheep on trails. It's really a joke. One of the many things they did wrong was to treat deflation, that is falling prices, as proof of depression, as Doug French explained very well, this introduces a very, very serious bias. A recession is when there's less goods being produced, not when goods are getting cheaper. And just correcting for that, as recent scholars have done, for example, there's that 1873 recession or depression that Doug was talking about, 5 years long according to the NBER, and only 2 years according to a more recent study. I'm running out of time, so let me just suffice to say, and here's where I can quote Christina Romer, recessions have not become noticeably shorter over time. The average length of recessions is actually 1 month longer in the post-World War II era than in the pre-World War I era. There is also no obvious change in the distribution of the length of recessions between the pre-war and post-war eras. Christina Romer, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, note the date of the publication. Where's my red? I can't see it. Can you? There it is. 1999, okay? Guess what happens if you update this? The conclusion gets what, stronger? Yeah, you bet. Okay, very quickly, right? I don't know, I don't see a 5 minute signal, but I bet I'll get it pretty soon. Banking panics. It used to be assumed that we had a lot more banking panics before the Fed than now, but a recent study by a graduate of the University of California, Berkeley, that famous headquarters of free market thought, or at least it's beginning to look so, has found that if instead of relying on exaggerated newspaper accounts, you look at the real evidence and define banking panics consistently, there's hardly any improvement after 1930. In fact, he writes, contrary to the conventional wisdom, there is no evidence of a decline in the frequency of panics during the first 15 years of the existence of the Federal Reserve. Now, there's another important date. There's no reduction until 1930. Well, of course, they were in a panic in 1930. So there's really no reduction until 1934. Why is there a reduction afterwards? It's all because of deposit insurance. Look, I hate deposit insurance more than anyone else in the world, perhaps. But what stopped conventional panics was that for a long time, and not the Fed. So the Fed can't get credit for having stopped conventional banking panics. Finally, well, I was going to talk more about the lender of last resort and all that. Let me just say very briefly on that subject that the conventional view of the lender of last resort, which is considered to be the enlightened view by almost all authorities, comes from Walter Badgett, who explained it back in 1873 in his book Lombard Street, where, by the way, he said it would be better not to have a central bank at all if you could avoid it. But accepting that the Bank of England was there to stay, he wrote that central banks in a crisis should lend freely at penalty rates on good security. The Fed has practically never done it. And, for example, there was a House study conducted for the years 1985 to 1991. 90% of the banks that received extended Fed credits during that period failed soon afterwards. And most of the others were in danger of failing. in the recent crisis, the Fed has violated Bagehot's rules more flagrantly than ever. As you know, it is engaged in so-called lender of last resort lending to an extent never before seen. But whereas Bagehot would have it lend only to sound solvent institutions, maintaining the liquidity of the solvent firms, not so as not to have them go under with the insolvent ones, and let the insolvent firms fail, what the Fed did in the recent crisis was to, of course, extend vast amounts of credit to institutions that were known to be insolvent. At the same time, until October 2008, it sterilized those loans, which meant it sold securities in the open market to withdraw liquidity from the rest of the economy. Listen to what I'm saying. It took liquidity from the solvent firms to give to the insolvent firms. This is turning Bagehot on his head. And it, of course, didn't do any good. I could say more about this, but I think I really need to draw to a close. I will give you just a hint, just a little hint, if I can find my little thing that I've been holding, of the... Oops, that's not it. It's a magic trick. I've made it go away. I'll have to learn how to do this again for some party. I'll give you a hint of what my conclusions are regarding what we should do about all this. But that's all I really have time for today. Thanks very much.